Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. This week we're here with Russ Chianelli, and we're going to be talking about eyes. We're going to be talking about genetic predispositions for disease in the eye. And Russ, who's going to be our guide through this sticky field?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Olaf Sundin. He's from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Welcome to Science Studio.
Okay, thank you.
Now, you're a PhD studying and researching in a medical school, so that's an interesting story by itself, and we'll get to that. But before we get too far involved with you and what you do, what were the driving forces for you to become a scientist, go out there and do research and get a PhD?
I think the main thing is I just had a really inspiring teacher in high school who was a biology teacher who had a sort of a very different attitude towards how one taught. His teaching was more focused around the laboratory, and actually instead of having a classroom with lectures, he actually had a lab.
How to do it rather than memorize and regurgitate.
Yeah, and everyone sort of worked at their own speed. The laboratory, his classroom was really a laboratory with all sorts of different stations. There would be a station where you would pick up a jar of some pickled animal and try to identify it, you know, as well as you could, and the station where you might sit and read some Scientific American reprints, which in those days were actually, you know, really...
You could read them.
Yeah, they were great. I don't know, it's just, it was quite an exceptional teacher, so I think that's what did it for me.
And so then you went on and you got to study. Tell us, where did you study?
I went on to study at Yale. I was actually sort of interested in doing English, which is actually came from my background because that wasn't my native language. I was born in Sweden and moved to the U.S. and started third grade in the U.S. So I sort of hadn't decided what I was going to really major in, but I ended up going into biology. And my interest at that time was primarily biochemistry. And so I went on to MIT to study biochemistry, and there I got into the genetics and went on to do postdocs in developmental biology, mainly in the nervous system, at first at Cold Spring Harbor and then at the MRC laboratory in Cambridge, England.
You've had a wonderful pedigree. I hope you're going to be a very successful researcher.
It was a lot of fun. And so then I came back to the U.S. and after spending a year in Houston, I moved to Johns Hopkins, where I became an assistant professor in a clinical department. It was quite a large clinical department called the Wilmer Eye Institute. And there I was interested in working on the early development of the eye, literally from the beginnings. And that's where I really developed my current interest, which is what it is that regulates the sort of the growth and shape of the eye and formation of the eye. And so during this time, I got to know a really superb clinical geneticist, Dr. Irene Momeny, and she had this database with thousands of patients with all kinds of genetic eye diseases. And so we started collaborating, and this led to really my current interest in genetics of eye diseases.
Who was the high school teacher that had the, I mean, that is something I think that a lot of our audience who are teachers, you know, it's a big issue here. How do you get people interested in science and technology and so on? Sound like he was the ideal guy.
He was an amazing guy. And, I mean, he actually really had gone back to high school. I think he was somebody who had originally thought he wanted to go to medical school. Then during World War II, he had been a medic in Europe. And
tough job.
When he came back, he taught at...
Where was this, by the way? In the U.S., right?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay.
And I still really haven't run into anyone quite like him. And I think that's one of the things that really is missing in some ways, is that I think there needs to be more latitude in the way teachers teach in high school.
You know, it's not just in high school, it's all over.
Because his formula, really, I can see, wouldn't work for some other, you know, some other areas.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's, again, the whole idea of having sort of innovative curricula and such is fine, but I think a lot of it becomes very top-down. And I think more of it has to sort of grow from the roots of inspiring individual teachers.
But one of the issues that we have, both Russ and I are chemists, is the experimental part, the laboratory part of chemistry, is given relatively short shrift. And partly that's because it's expensive. Secondly, because there's an element of risk. And, you know, God knows if you go to a laboratory and say, well, today we're going to make hydrogen over here, oxygen here, and we're going to meet it in the middle. There's already, you know, well, wait a moment. and that's a problem. We have to do something that's risky, I think.
And I think many of the most successful Nobel Prize winners write exactly about this. You know, not force-feeding, but the way to learn is to, you know, sort of be taking some risk, as Keith's saying, and being able to do with your own hands. That's the way I learned.
Yeah.
And it seems to be something that's been lost.
Yeah, we may come back to that when it applies to medical school and how you teach the future generations of medicine. But let's get on to this business of eye disease and the degree to which genetics are involved. And is there a particular disease that you focus upon?
Well, the disease that we're focusing on now is something called nanophthalmos, and it's the Greek term for dwarf eye. And these individuals have an eye that's, in a sense, perfectly formed and functional, but it's just very small. And I was fascinated by the fact that individuals who have this condition typically have only the eye affected, and both eyes are affected. It allows us to sort of at first say this is almost certainly a genetic condition, and it had been known for a few decades that the condition was inherited typically as a Mendelian recessive trait.
So that means that previous, I mean, one of the questions that's interesting to me is evolution of the eye. So this is an older species of eye, is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't say that. To give you an idea of how tricky the evolutionary argument can be is, for example, once we identified, I'll get to this later, but mice who have the same genetic mutation have a normal-sized eye.
Do they have anything else that's smaller
normal? They have a degenerative disorder of the retina. Patients with this condition also have a mild degenerative disorder of the retina, not nearly as severe as in the mouse. So actually between the two species, the same gene seems to be doing different things.
So you really could say this is sort of a throwback gene that's related to a mouse.
No, what I would actually say is that the mouse is probably a kind of degenerate version of a prototypical vertebrate, and we fit into the more conservative version of this. And the mouse, being a radical nocturnal animal, has an eye that's actually built very differently from ours. It has a huge lens, and there are other features that are different as well. So I think it's due to the fact that the mouse is a very specialized eye.
When you say few people in a population of a million, what's the normal occurrence of this particular dwarf eye syndrome?
Well, this is about 1 out of 30,000 people would have this condition. So it's fairly rare. At least the most severe form, the genetic form, is about 1 out of 30,000. But if you look at people in the clinic who have it, it's probably higher. It's probably around 1 in 10 to 1 in 5,000. It's actually a more common condition than people had thought before.
But it's common because they have the small eye.
Right.
But their vision can be perfect.
Why
would they come to you?
Some people can actually have quite good vision. The reason why this becomes a serious issue is that many of them can develop a condition known as angle closure glaucoma, in which the outflow of the aqueous is a fluid that's in the front, very front of the eye, that's inhibited by the shape of the eye. And therefore, you end up with high pressure and damage to the optic nerve. Because of the high pressure.
How small is small? What are you talking about? Can you just see a tiny eye?
No. Well, just to give you an idea, the length of the eye is normal human eyes about 24 millimeters. These eyes are on the order of about 16 millimeters in length. They have about 1/4 the volume of a normal human eye.
So it's really a volume effect in a sense that the ordinary person not knowing this wouldn't notice it if somebody was in the room.
Actually not, because the very front of the eye is relatively normal in size.
Yeah.
It's the back of the eye, and that's hidden inside your eye socket. So actually, these people, if they're not wearing their glasses, which would be usually very strong glasses because they're extremely farsighted, they're extremely hyperopic. If they're not wearing those glasses, it's very hard to detect anything really unusual.
Okay. So let me ask a pie-in-the-sky question, which comes to my mind listening to you talk about this. When you talk about genetics and a defect like that, is there any hope in the future that you can actually redirect the genes and, say, fix it?
Yes, there is, and that's something that we're working on. So in this case, we studied the pedigree of a large Amish Mennonite kindred in which this disease was being inherited as a Mendelian recessive. And within a few years, we were able to map the gene on the genome. And then another couple of years, we were able to identify the mutation that causes the gene. So in this case, we know the genetic defect behind roughly 20% of individuals with this condition. And we know where the gene is expressed. It's expressed in a layer of cells called the pigment epithelium, which is a kind of a layer of darkly pigmented, melanin-pigmented cells at the back of the eye that are essential for sustaining the eye. And what we think is going on is that this gene is somehow involved in helping the retina to adhere to the pigment epithelium. So another condition that these people are very susceptible to is retinal detachment. If you have a retinal detachment and the retina is not brought back into contact with the pigment epithelium, the retina, the light-detecting cells in the retina will die within a relatively short time, within a couple of weeks, they're gone. And that's one of the risks that these patients have, is retinal detachment.
A little bit about how one reattaches a retina. I mean, it sounds trivial. Oh, well, it's like, you know, stick them. You put it back.
But it's not crazy glue.
Yeah. How does that function?
Well, there are a number of ways that that's done. I mean, one is that when a retina detaches, often fluid comes in underneath. There's often a tear in the retina, and then fluid comes in underneath it. And so that fluid is an essential block. So the ocular surgeon has to push the retina back onto the surface of the RPE, and then various things typically are done to hold it in place, either some kind of special tacks or sutures, or sometimes even a bit of a laser is put in there to scar. There are a variety of, with this condition, actually, it's especially difficult to reattach the retina. That's one of the things we hope that we can actually develop new techniques for reattaching the retina for these patients. The first patient we studied with this, I mean, she's completely blind in one eye and has...
Because of a retinal detachment.
Because of a retinal detachment.
You've got a disease. It's far more common than those of us that don't daily see patients with ocular problems. You know it's a genetic feature. Parenthetically, are there any racial preferences? I mean, is it equally for Caucasians, Asians, etc.?
Actually, we don't know yet, but there are reports in really all groups.
You did
really
say something about Mennonites.
It's really widespread in all racial groups we can imagine. I mean, there's a recent paper where they've found it in population in New Guinea, in Tunisia, in Asia, everywhere, really. So I think it's not a – in that sense. But there may be differences in terms of the way the disease manifests itself in different population groups.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli and Olaf Sundin from the Texas Tech Medical School here in El Paso. We'll be back shortly.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. People can now have a procedure that you probably can't believe anybody would need or want, a fecal transplant.
I know it sounds disgusting and bizarre, but it's actually not new. Fecal transplants were first tried in the 1950s and are now back thanks to superbugs. These are bacteria that have become resistant to antibiotics, partly due to the widespread use of antibiotics on animal farms.
In particular, some Clostridium difficile, or C. diff, are now super-resistant bacteria. They cause intestinal diseases such as bloody diarrhea and kill almost 15,000 Americans every year.
Just under a fifth of us actually carry C. diff as part of our gut flora, but it's kept in check by other bacteria there. This normal flora called the microbiome keeps us disease-free. But when that's disrupted by an underlying illness or after antibiotic therapy to treat another infection, then C. diff can flourish.
This is where fecal therapy comes in. The rationale is if normal flora keeps C. diff in check, then it has to be restored. The challenge was finding reliable disease-free fecal matter to transplant.
So a group of enterprising graduate students created Open Biome, in part because they watched a friend struggle with C. diff. Open Biome collects, tests, and distributes stool samples for transplant, much like a blood bank distributes blood.
Samples are obtained, tested, and certified by FDA procedures, which cost around $3,000. Then they're frozen to negative 80 degrees Celsius and shipped to physicians and hospitals for transplantation.
This emphasizes how much our health relies on a healthy microbiome. We should be closely monitoring our small friends.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Olaf Sundin, and we're talking about a particular disease, which I won't go into the real name, but dwarf eye seems to me sums up what I've heard so far, and it's a genetic disease. Now, tell us, Olaf, what is it you're trying to do? You know the disease, as I was alluding to before. We know it's genetic. What are the features of this disease that you're trying to tackle?
Well, the first thing we're trying to tackle is really how the mutations cause the disease. We really don't know.
You mean at a basic chemical?
At the basic biological level.
Well, identifying a particular part of the DNA or...
Well, no, we know that. At this point, we have a mutation which completely knocks out the function of this gene. So these people who are missing the functional copies of the gene seem to have nothing else wrong with them anywhere else in their body. It's just the eye doesn't grow to its full size. The eye is functional, but there's something special about the way this gene regulates the growth of the eye. And we believe that this is tied in with the natural mechanism of growth of the eye that happens during childhood. At birth, children have, their eyes have very different levels of focus. And there's a process known as emmetropization, whereby the eye adjusts its focus during childhood to either be in perfect focus, which is actually the majority of people, and then you have some variation of people who are nearsighted or farsighted. So it turns out that there's a very highly conserved process which is found in many different species, and including chickens, which are actually perhaps the best known experimental system for studying this, where the retina, that's the light detecting part of the eye, somehow is able to determine whether images are in focus and then adjust the growth of the eye to bring the eye into perfect focus. And what we think is going on in this disease is that the signaling between the retina and the rest of the eye requires this gene. And we don't know how that signaling works, and we're trying to understand how that happens.
You have this defective what?
Protein. It's a membrane protein.
Membrane protein. How would you fix it, theoretically?
Well, one way to fix it would be to introduce a fully functional copy of the gene into that layer of cells. And this is something that we're working towards. One of the current, you know, approaches to gene therapy is to introduce genes into different tissues in the eye to fix a specific genetic defect. We have identified the gene, and now it would be a matter of introducing it into the individual.
How do you go from where you are and you've discovered it now to a clinical trial? You can't work on chickens, can you?
No, we can't.
Why? Why can't you work on chickens?
Because they're different enough.
We don't have the mutation in the chickens. Where I would like to go is really to, in terms of the directions we're going with the genetics, which is really to sort of to understand how the disease as a whole, I mean, you've hit on the problem, which is that without a clear animal model, we don't know, we can't show that the human disease is going to be cured by introducing the gene back into the eye. I mean, there is a mouse model, which is a retinal degeneration, but that's not the primary problem that people with the human disease have.
So what is, therefore, Olaf, the direction that you're going in your own research?
Well, I think what we're trying to understand really how the disease works, and that we're hoping that will lead to ways of treating it that do not necessarily involve gene therapy. Gene therapy, as it stands today, using viral vectors, involves considerable risk.
How do you study the mechanism of a disease? You've got different cells that you're looking at, and how does it work?
Well, we are, in fact, going to be using the chicken as a system to study what the function of this gene is. We're in the process of using a method called RNAi, and this is something called interfering RNA, which is able to sort of turn down the expression of genes. And so we're in the process of setting up a chicken model to do this and to essentially replicate the function of the mutation in a system where the growth of the eye more closely mimics that of the human. Now, the reason why we don't work with the mouse is that the mouse has a very different mode of growth of the eye.
And so how does the experiment work? The experiment that you're setting up to do with the chicken model, what do you do? You take cells from chicken eyes and...
We take a chicken virus that carries a piece of RNA that's engineered to decrease the expression level of this particular gene. So from that, we will then begin to look at the chicken eye to see if some of the pathological features can be developed. But the thing we're going to be looking at the most is to see whether growth of the whole eye is affected in the same way.
Okay.
Among the other things that we need to understand is this gene is expressed on the surface of one cell layer, and it has domains in it that we suspect bind to other proteins. And we're trying to identify those other proteins. And in a sense, by finding those interactions, we hope to determine something about how the gene works. Now, ultimately, we're hoping that we can, in some way, restore some of the function to an individual's eye. And it may not be by correcting the gene function. It may be actually by using certain drugs that modify other aspects of eye function. So by understanding the function, we hope that we can use really the current arsenal of medical treatment and medical procedures possibly to really optimize the treatment of this condition. So really, we're not after a complete fix. We're in a sense trying to learn how an eye doctor can do better in treating this condition.
So that brings up the sort of the $64,000 question. You're a basic biomedical researcher. You happen to be in a medical school, but you're quite separate from the day-to-day clinical business. What's the advantage for you to be doing this sort of research in a medical school environment compared to a department of cell biology or biochemistry?
Well, I think it's the patients, the people with these diseases. We wouldn't be seeing them if we weren't in a medical school. And that was the big advantage of being at Hopkins is that you had the patients and you had, as colleagues, the doctors who see them. And really, I think that one of the features that is lost on a lot of people and also on people in the medical community sometimes is that there isn't always that sharp boundary between research and clinical practice. You know, many important discoveries have been made by doctors taking a second look at that patient, taking a bit more time to think about what they're seeing and talking with their colleagues about it and presenting it. And I think that's something that as a PhD researcher I can benefit from enormously.
In a sense, what you're saying is one of the pet things that Russ is always talking about, the whole concept of interdisciplinary interaction.
Exactly.
You know, if we stay in our little boxes, you know, we may make great progress, but we may quite make progress and miss the key feature over here because we don't have those conversations.
Right.
Now, you teach in the medical school also, right? You have responsibility for classes?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I have at Texas Tech, we have a sort of a dedicated teaching staff, but I'm in the process of setting up the second year curriculum. It's a new medical school, so we have really a first year class, and when they get to the second year class, then we implement the second year curriculum. The curriculum is really quite interesting there, is that the curriculum at Paul Foster School of Medicine here in El Paso is is centered around patients and a problem that a patient will have. The students spend a whole week or sometimes a couple of weeks following all the possible ways to diagnose a certain situation, such as a sore throat or a sore eye or, you know, or a red eye. Or
a possible palsy.
Palsy, right. And they learn to go through not just one diagnosis, but essentially almost all possible diagnoses. And they're guided through that process. And then as they go through that, this is unusual for a first-year curriculum, as they go through that, the different basic science issues at each point are brought in, and they're sort of hung onto that framework. And it's quite exciting, and it's one of the reasons why I'm here.
Is that a model that was developed here in El Paso?
It was developed in Alberta in Canada, but then that model in turn had been taken from a model that was implemented a couple decades ago in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve. So it's not a widespread model, but it's gained increasing. There's a lot of interest in it.
The other day I was looking at a hawk very high, and it said that the hawk, even at that level, can see a tiny mouse moving, and that's what it's doing, looking for things moving. So it must have a very different kind of eye. And I know that it's we don't have much time here, but it makes me think about, what were the earliest animals that had eyes that we would call eyes? What were just light sensors? Or could you say a little bit about that?
Okay, the evolution of the eye is a problem that actually Darwin treated in his Origin of the Species. And he started with the very simplest eyes, just a light-sensitive patch, and then if that light-sensitive patch is put into a pit on the surface of the skin, you can get directionality out of the inputs into the eye. And then the concept, and again, Darwin was able to see this as a zoologist by looking at many different species, is that the eye is built up in pieces. And in a sense, his interest in it was that how can such a complex organ be built by the process
accident.
Of evolution, seeming like, or by guided accident, in a sense, or by selection. And he built up that case. And now, so the question is, the answer is there are many different kinds of eyes. Now what we know since Darwin is that many of them seem to have started from, in molecular terms, many of them are related to each other. And there's a single gene that causes an eye disease, human eye disease, called PAX6. And this gene is also involved in fly eye development. This gene is so conserved through evolution that if one takes the human PAX6 gene, and you can either take the human gene or you can take the fly gene and you put it into a fly, you can actually make extra eyes develop on arms and legs of the fly.
Yeah, I've seen photographs like that.
And yeah.
It's horrifying to the general public, of course.
Yeah, but nothing like that has been done with mice or such.
You can see a time when the mother could put eyes in the back of her head, for example.
I think some mothers already do have eyes in the back of their head. But that's a whole other area. But understanding development really is going to allow us to make, in a sense, replacement parts for the eye.
That's something to look forward to. We've come to the end of the program, so
thank you very much.
No, au contraire. Thank you for being here. It's been very interesting, as Russ said.
Yeah, please come back to Science Studio sometime, and let's talk about the eye and evolution's many forms. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thanks for the audience out there listening to this highly successful and highly rated program. We will be back next week with another program. Bye-bye.